Heard she saw grizzly bears.
You just want to see her naked butt, Vlade pointed out.
Doesn't everybody?
Vlade nodded. It did seem to be an important aspect of the popularity of her show. Not now, boys. I've got work to do here. You can check her out later. Off with you.
He looked around his office, saw a box of pasta salad he had brought back from the kitchen and never gotten to.
Hey, take this and feed it to the water rats.
I thought we were the water rats, the taller one said. That's what he meant, the shorter one said, snatching the box from Vlade before he might change his mind. Thanks, mister.
All right, get out of here.
New York is in a constant state of mutation. If a city conceivably may be compared to a liquid, it may be reasonably said that New York is fluid. It flows, observed Carl Van Vechten. Heaters were put in the steeply sloping roof of the Chrysler Building to stop ice from forming on it and sliding off onto Lexington Avenue with bad results. But after the second pulse, people forgot this system existed. And then...
E. A citizen. New York, New York, it's a hell of a bay. Henry Hudson sailed by and saw a break in the coast between two hills, right at the deepest part of the bight they were exploring. A bight is an indentation in a coastline too broad and open to be called a bay, such that you could sail out of it on a single tack. If you don't care about such an antiquarian sailor's fact, bite me. Sail ahead a page or two to resume voyeuring the sordidities of the puny primates crawling or paddling around this great bay. If you're okay pondering the big picture, the ground truth, read on. The bight of New York forms an almost 90-degree angle where the north-southish Jersey shore meets the east-westish Long Island, and right there at the bend there's a gap. It's only a mile wide, and yet once through it, hopefully coming in on a rising tide as it's much easier that way, like Hudson, you will come into a humongous harbor, unlike anything you've ever seen before. People call it a river, but it's more than a river. It's a fjord, or a fjard, if you want to be geologically prissy about it. It was one drip line coming off the world-topping ice cap of the Ice Age, which was such a monster that the entirety of Long Island is just one of its moraines. When the great ice monster melted 10,000 years ago, sea level rose about 300 feet. The Atlantic came up and filled all the valleys of the eastern seaboard, as can be easily discerned on any map, and in that process the ocean sloshed into the Hudson, as well as into the valley between New England and the Long Island Moraine, creating Long Island Sound, then the East River, and all of the rest of the vast complicated mess of marshes, creeks, and tidal races that is our bay in question. In this great estuary there are some remnant ridges of hard old rock, skinny low long lines of hills, now peninsulas in the general flood. One runs south down the western side of the bay, dividing the Hudson from the Meadowlands, that's the Palisades and Hoboken, pointing to the big lump that is Staten Island. One anchors the moraine of Long Island angling in from the east, Brooklyn Heights. And the third runs south down the middle of the bay, and because of a swamp cutting across its northern end, it's technically an island. Rocky, hilly, forested, meadowed, ponded. That's Manhattan. Forest? Okay, now it's a forest of skyscrapers. A city, and such a city, that it used to take some looking to see it as an estuary. Since the floods, that's become easier. Because although it was drowned coastline before, it is now more drowneder than ever. 50 feet higher sea level means a much bigger bay, more tidally confused, Hellgate more hellish, the Harlem River, a wild tidal race and not a shipping canal. The Meadowlands, a shallow sea. Brooklyn and Queens and the South Bronx, all shallow seas, their prismatically oily waters sloshing poisonously back and forth on the tides. Yes. A total mess of a bay, still junked up by bridges and pipelines and rusting sclerotic infrastructural junk of all kinds. And so the animals have come back, the fish, the fowl, the oysters, quite a few of them two-headed and fatal to ingest, but back. People, too, are back, of course, having never left, still everywhere. They're like cockroaches, you can't get rid of them. And yet, all the other animals don't care. They swim around living their lives, they scavenge and predate and browse and get by and avoid people. Just like any other New Yorker. So, it's still New York. People can't give up on it. It's what economists used to call the tyranny of sunk costs. Once you've put so much time and money into a project, it gets hard to just eat your losses and walk. You are forced by the structure of the situation to throw good money after bad. Grow obsessed, double down, escalate your commitment, and become a mad, gibbering apartment dweller, unable to imagine leaving. You persevere unto death, a monomaniacal New Yorker to the end. Under all the human crap, the island, too, perseveres. Initially, it was known for its hills and ponds, but they chopped down the hills and filled in the ponds with the dirt from the chopped hills to make the flattest real estate they could, hoping also to improve traffic. Not that that did any good, but whatever. All gone now. Pretty much flat, although the floods of the 21st century revealed a salient fact that wasn't very important before. Lower Manhattan is indeed much lower than Upper Manhattan, like by about 50 vertical feet on average, and that has made all the difference. The floods inundated New York Harbor and every other coastal city around the world, mainly in two big surges that shoved the ocean up 50 feet. And in that flooding, Lower Manhattan went under, and Upper Manhattan did not. Incredible that this could happen. So much ice off Antarctica and Greenland. Could there be that much ice to make that much water? Yes, there could. And so the first pulse and second pulse, each a complete psychodrama decade, a meltdown in history, a breakdown in society, a refugee nightmare, an eco-catastrophe, the planet gone collectively nuts. The Anthropocide, the Hydra-catastrophe, the Geo-revolution. Also great new options for investment and, oh dear, the necessity of police state crowd control as expressed in draconian new laws and ad hoc practices, what some called the Egyptification of the world, but we won't go there now. That's pessimistic boo-hooing and giving upness, more suitable for the melodramas describing individual fates and the watery decades than this grandly sweeping overview. Back to the island itself. Locus omphalos of our mutual mania. The southern half, from about 40th Street right down to the Battery, was all drowned all the time, up to the second or third floor of every building that did not quickly collapse or melt into the drink. North of 42nd, much of the west side stood well higher than the 50-foot rise in ocean. On the east side, water covered the big flats of Harlem and the Bronx, and it also flooded the Big Dip at 125th Street, which people actually took the trouble of filling in with landfill, as it was too inconvenient to have the northern end of the island cut off, especially as the Cloisters and Inwood Hill Park were revealed to be the highest ground around, as high as anywhere in the greater harbor region. You had to look to the Palisades or Staten Island or Brooklyn Heights to see anything as high as the very northern tip of Manhattan. And since this long strip forming the northern half of the island remained well above the flood, naturally people from the submerged neighborhoods took refuge on it, went crazy for it. It became like downtown in the 19th century, or midtown in the 20th. The Cloister Cluster, capital of the 22nd century, or so they like to imagine up there. The constant northward drift suggests that in another century or two, all the action will remove to Yonkers or Westchester County, so buy land up there now. Although sue this commentator for slander if he says no fucking way. But people have said that before. For now, the north end of Manhattan is the capital of capital, the proving ground for the new composite building materials for skyscrapers. Materials invented for not yet happening space elevator cables, but in the meantime, great for 300-story superscrapers, needling far up into the clouds, such that when you are in their uppermost floors, on one of the nosebleed terraces trying to conquer your altitude sickness and looking south, downtown looks like a kid's train set left behind in a flooded basement. You could bat the moon out of the sky from those terraces. And so, New York keeps on happening. The skyscrapers, the people and what have yous, the New Jerusalem, in both its English and Jewish manifestations, the two ethnic dreams weirdly collapsing together and in the vibration of their interference pattern, creating the city on the hill, the city on the island, the new Rome, the capital of the 20th century, the capital of the world, the capital of capital, the unchallenged center of the planet, the diamond iceberg between rivers, the busiest, noisiest, fastest-growing, most advanced, most cosmopolitan, coolest, most desirable, most photogenic of cities. The sun at the center of all the wealth in the universe. The center of the universe, the spot where the Big Bang occurred. The capital of hype, too, you think? Madison Avenue will sell you anything, including that totally bogus list above. And so, yes, the capital of bullshit. The capital of horse shit, also the capital of chicken shit. Weaseling along, pretending to be something special without changing anything in the world, and ultimately grinding along just like any other ridiculous money-crazed megalopolis on the planet, especially those located on coasts, formerly great trading centers and now completely fucked. But toujours gay, Archie, toujours gay. And like most of the other coastal cities, it's limped along as best it could. People keep living here, bad as it is. And more than that, people keep coming here, despite the suicidal stupidity of that. The way it is, in effect, volunteering for hell. People are like lemmings. They are mammals with herd instincts, very much like the instincts of cows. In short, morons. So it isn't all that special, this New York of ours. And yet, and yet, and yet, and yet, maybe there's something to it. Hard to believe, hard to admit, pain-in-the-ass place that it is, bunch of arrogant fuckheads. No reason for it to be anything special, a coincidence, just the luck of the landscape, the bay and the bite, the luck of the draw. Space and time congealing to a history, to have come into being in its moment, accidentally growing the head, guts, and tumescent genitals of the American dream, the magnet for desperate dreamers. The place made of people from everywhere else, the city of immigrants, the people made of other people, very rude people, loud-mouthed, obnoxious assholes often, but more often just oblivious and doing their own thing with no regard for you or yours. Many strangers banging into each other, dodging each other, yelling at each other sometimes, but really mostly just ignoring each other. Almost polite, you might say. Using the city's sharpened skill of looking past or through people or not seeing the other. The crowd's just background tapestries for you to play your life against. Lurid backdrops providing a fake sense of drama to help you imagine you're doing more than you would be if you were in some sleepy village or Denver or really anywhere else. New York, the great stage set. Well, there may be something to it. Anyway, there it lies, filling the Great Bay, no matter what you think or believe about it, spiking out of the water like a long bed of poisonous sea urchins onto which dreamers cling as to an inconveniently prickly life raft, their only refuge on the vast and windy deep, gasping like Aquaman and seemingly impossible to survive superheroes' fake low point, still dreaming their fever dreams of glorious success. If you can make it here, you'll make it anywhere. Maybe even Denver.
In 1924, Hubert Fauntleroy Julian, the Black Eagle, the first Negro to obtain a pilot's license, parachuted onto Harlem, wearing a devil's costume and playing the saxophone. Later he flew to Europe and challenged Hermann Göring to an air duel. A pygmy named Ota Benga was exhibited for a month in the primate house of the Bronx Zoo, 1906. Typically American, we had no ideology. Abby Hoffman.
F. Amelia. One of Amelia Black's favorite flyways ran from Montana east over the Missouri River and south toward the Ozarks, then east into Kentucky and through the Delaware Gap, and across the Pine Barrens, briefly out to sea and up to New York. For this entire distance, her airship, the Assisted Migration, flew over wildlife habitat and sky ag corridors. And if she kept to a low enough altitude, which she did, there were hardly any signs of people, just a tower here or there, or a cluster of lights on the horizon at night. Of course there were many other skycraft in the sky, from personal airships like hers to freight dirigibles to spinning sky villages and everything in between. The skies could seem crowded, but below her, North America stretched out looking as empty of people as it had been 50,000 years ago. That wasn't even remotely true, and when she reached her destination, she would be reminded of the real state of affairs in a big way. But for the 4 days of her voyage, the continent looked like wilderness. Amelia's cloud show was about assisting the migration of endangered species to ecozones where they were more likely to survive the changed climate. So the sight of all the nearly unoccupied land passing below, for hour after hour, was fairly common for her, but nevertheless, always encouraging to see. She and her cloud audience could not but realize that there were indeed habitat corridors, well established, and in them wild animals could live, eat, reproduce, and move in whatever directions the climate pushed them. They could migrate to survive. And some of them were even lucky enough to catch a lift in the right direction on the assisted migration. This trip had started over the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, one of her favorites. Her ultra-zoom cameras showed her audience herds of elk chased by packs of wolves, and a mother grizzly and cub she had featured before, Mabel and Elma. Then came the high plains, mostly abandoned by people even before the habitat corridors had been established, now occupied mainly by vast herds of buffalo and wild horses. Then the convoluted ridges of the northern Ozarks, green and gnarly, followed by the wide braided floodplains of the Mississippi River, dense with flocks of birds. Here, she had hovered to catch images of a sky village swooping down onto an immense apple orchard and harvesting it from above, deploying scoops and nets and carrying off a crop of apples without ever touching down. Then the rolling hills of Kentucky, where North America's great eastern hardwood forest covered the world with an endless carpet of leaves. Here, as she headed toward the Delaware Gap, she dropped the assisted migration low enough to take a closer look at the top of the canopy, an unbroken, billowy spread of oaks, walnuts, and elms. 500 feet was the champion height from which to view landscapes, and even more so if an attractive woman was lowered from the airship's gondola on a long line, after which she could swing back and forth like a Gibson girl under a tree. Although in this case, over the tree. Today, a red sleeveless dress. There would, of course, be viewers hoping she might get enthusiastic and take the dress off and throw it fluttering down into the trees, where it would match some of the autumn's turning leaves. She was not going to do that. She had retired from that part of her career, as she kept telling her producer, Nicole. But the dress would make her exceptionally visible. And if it blew up around her waist from time to time, well, these things happened. Swinging over the world from below her airship was one of Amelia's signature moves. Now she did it again, leaving the assisted migration in the hands of her very capable autopilot, Franz. Back and forth on the swing seat, pulling hard on the ropes until she was swooping like a pendulum weight over the endless rolling quilt of autumn leaves, glorying in the rush and beauty of the visible world. But then Franz spoke up through her earbud to report that the motor necessary to reel her line back up into the gondola had failed again, something it was prone to do when the line was at full extension. She was stuck down there at the end of the line. Oh no! This had happened before. Amelia's producers had assured her that the motor was fixed, and yet here she was again, hanging 200 feet below the airship and just above the trees. Getting cold in the wind, actually. Could not just stay hanging in the air all the way to New York. A problem. But Amelia was used to these kinds of situations. She wasn't called Amelia Earhart for nothing. And she was in good contact with Franz. The wind was mild, and after some thought and discussion, Franz lowered the airship until Amelia could kick around in the uppermost leaves and twigs of the forest canopy, find one of the highest branches of an elm, and stand on it. Yay! There she rested like a dryad, thigh deep in foliage, looking up at the assisted migration and her various camera drones with a plucky smile. "Now watch this, people," Amelia said. "I think Franz and I have figured out a solution to this one. Oh, look, there's a squirrel. It's either a red squirrel or a gray squirrel. They're not as easy to tell apart as the names would lead you to believe." Franz kept lowering the airship toward her, the swing's rope coiling down past her into the forest, until the craft filled her sky and its gondola almost knocked her on the head. She ducked and talked it over with Franz in a somewhat urgent back and forth. Then the open bay door of the gondola dropped slowly beside her, smushing down into the leaves until she was able to grab its doorway and pull herself into the bay. After that, she undid her harness and hauled in the swing line by hand, pulling hard a few times to unsnag it from branches below. When it was all inside, she told Franz to shut the door and rise, while she hustled back upstairs to get some hot chocolate into her. Her audience had liked it, feedback indicated, although, as usual, there were sad viewers complaining that she had stayed dressed. Prominent among them, her producer, Nicole, who warned her it was going to lose her viewers. Amelia ignored them all, Nicole in particular. On they flew, over the scrubby pine barrens, then the green and empty New Jersey shore, which had been a drowned coastline even before the floods, then out over the blue Atlantic. Thus, as she reminded her audience, they had flown over one corridor in the great system of corridors that now shared the continent with its cities and farms, and the interstate highways and the railways and power lines. Overlapping worlds, a stack of overlays, an accidental megastructure, a post-carbon landscape, each of the many networks performing its function in the great dance, and the habitat corridors providing a life space for their horizontal brothers and sisters, as Amelia called them on her broadcasts. All creatures made good use of these corridors, which, if not pure wilderness, were at least wilderness-y, and it was easy to wax enthusiastic about their success while flying over them at 500 feet. Critics of her program, and of assisted migration more generally, never tired of pointing out that she was just one more charismatic megafauna. Like her favorite subjects, flying over the essential groundwork of lichen and fungi and bacteria and the BLM, all the complicated work of photosynthesis, an eminent domain, where things were ever so much more complicated than she ever deigned to notice. Well, she had done her share of that work too, as anyone could find out by looking into her past. And now it was her time to fly. Franz took the airship well out over the Atlantic, then turned left and flew north toward New York. At the intersection of New Jersey and Long Island, the tiny gray stitch that was the Verrazano Narrows Bridge appeared. And north of that, the great city quickly came into view in all its watery magnificence, visible as a patchwork under a light marine layer of white clouds. New York Harbor was a very human space, no doubt about it, even though it too was an ecozone, the amazing Manhattan ecosystem. But the human element dominated it. Awesome. Sublime, even refreshing after the monotony of the eastern hardwood forest and the high plains. From her vantage, the Great Harbor looked like a model of itself, a riot of tiny buildings and bridges, an intricate assemblage of gray forms. Lower Manhattan was water-floored and just one small part of the big bay, but so densely studded with skyscrapers and bordered with docks that the old outline of the island was easy to see. Upper Manhattan remained above water and had become more crowded with buildings than ever, including many new skyscrapers, the colorful, shapely, graffinated towers north of Central Park that thrust far higher into the sky than those in downtown and midtown ever had. This had the effect of making Lower Manhattan look more sunk than it really was. Amelia narrated the sights to her audience with the astonishment common to all Manhattan tour guides. See how Hoboken's been built up? That's quite a wall of super scrapers. They look like a spur of the Palisades that never got ground down in the Ice Age. Too bad about the Meadowlands. It was a great salt marsh. Although now, it makes a nice extension of the bay, doesn't it? The Hudson is really a glacial trench filled with seawater. It's not just an ordinary riverbed. The mighty Hudson. Yikes. This is one of the greatest wildlife sanctuaries on Earth, people. It's another case of overlapping communities. She swung the camera around to the east. Brooklyn and Queens make a very strange-looking bay. To me, it looks like some kind of rectangular coral reef exposed at low tide. Franz was bringing the assisted migration down over what remained of Governor's Island, so she said. The little piece of Governor's Island still above water is the original island. The underwater part was landfill, made with the dirt they excavated when they dug the Lexington Avenue subway. Nicole sent a text saying it was time to wrap up, so Amelia said, "Okay, folks, it's been great having you along. Thanks all of you for traveling with me." Her cloud numbers had been strong, averaging 32 million viewers for the duration of her trip, half of them international. This made her one of the biggest cloud stars of all, and among those focused on nature, absolutely the Black Swan megastar. I hope you come back and join me again. For now, here we are coming in over the 23rd Street Canal. I never know what to call them. They were very particular in Lower Manhattan about not calling anything a street anymore. It marks you as coming from out of town. But I am from out of town, so whatever. Franz floated them past the downtown skyscrapers and turned east toward the old MetLife Tower. Already she could see the little gilded pyramid of its cupola, rising above Madison Square. There were any number of taller buildings around the bay, but it still dominated its immediate neighborhood. Amelia called in to confirm her arrival. "Vlade, I'm coming in from the west. Are you ready for me?"
"Always," Vlade replied after a short pause.
Wind sometimes got fluky over Manhattan, but today she headed into a steady east wind of about 10 knots. Looked like high tide in the city, water reaching up the Bay Avenue canals almost to Central Park. At low tide, the water line would be down near the Empire State Building, now looming to her left. She had considered living there, its blimp mast being so much higher, but the old tower had become fashionable, and even though Amelia was one of the most famous of the cloud stars, she couldn't afford it. Besides, she liked the MetLife Tower better. Franz and the mast took over. The airship's turbines hummed, her gondola yawed and tilted. The hiss of expelled helium and air joined the various whooshes of wind and the general hum of the city. A susurrus of thousands of wakes bouncing off buildings. Also boat motors, horns, the usual urban clatter. Ah, yes, New York. Skyscrapers and everything. Amelia had been born and raised in Grants Pass, Oregon, and because of that, she loved New York passionately, more than any of the natives ever knew enough to feel. The real locals were like fish in water, unaware and unimpressed. The assisted migration's hook latched onto the mast, and the airship swung a little, and soon the tube of the Met's walkway leached up to her from under the eaves of the cupola, and seized her gondola's starboard door. The inner door opened, and with a quick whoosh, the air equalized, and she grabbed her bag and descended the inflatable stairs into the top of the building, took the spiral stairs and then the elevator down to her apartment on the 40th floor, looking south and east. Home, sweet home. Amelia had a teeny kitchen nook in her closet of an apartment, but like most residents of the Met, she ate her dinners in the dining hall downstairs. So after showering, she went down to eat. As always, the dining hall and common room were jammed, hundreds of people in the serving lines and crowded side by side at long tables, talking and eating. It reminded Amelia of tadpoles in a pond. Quite a few of them waved hello to her and then left her alone,
which was just how she liked it. Vlade was at his table by the window overlooking the Bacino, sitting with a woman Amelia didn't know. Amelia approached, and Vlade introduced them.
4020, this is 2040. Ha! Amelia Black. Inspector Jen Octavius Dottir.
Nice to meet you, Amelia said, as they shook hands. The policewoman said she had seen Amelia's show. Thanks, Amelia said. Appreciate you watching. When did you move into the building?
6 years ago, Jen said. I moved in with my mom to help when she got sick. Then when she died, I stayed.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jen shrugged.
I'm finding out it's not that unusual here.
The cooks rang the bell for the last call, and Amelia stood to go see what was still there. That bell has become totally Pavlovian for me, she said. It rings, and I'm starving. She came back with a plate of salad and the dregs from several nearly empty bowls. As she dug in, Vlade and Jen talked about people Amelia didn't know. Somebody had gone missing, it sounded like. When she was done eating, she checked her wrist pad for cloud mail and laughed.
What's up?
Vlade said. Well, I thought I was going to be here for a while, Amelia said. But this sounds too good to pass on. I've been asked to assist another migration.
Like what you always do?
This time, it's polar bears.
High profile, Jen noted. Where can you move them?
Vlade asked.
The moon?
It's true they can't go any farther north, so they want to move them to Antarctica.
But I thought that was melted too.
Not completely. They'll probably be okay there, but I don't know. You can't just move a top predator. They have to have something to eat. Let me ask. She tapped her pad for her producer, and Nicole picked up immediately. Amelia, I was hoping you'd call. What do you think? I think it's crazy, Amelia said. What would they eat down there?
Weddell seals, mainly.
We've done the analysis. There's lots of biomass. There aren't as many orcas as there used to be, so there's more seals. Another top predator might help keep them in balance. Meanwhile, we're down to about 200 wild polar bears around the whole Arctic, and people are freaking out. They're about to go extinct in the wild. So, how many are you talking about moving?
About 20 to start. If you agree to this, you'll take 6 of them. Your people will love it.
The defenders will hate it.
I know, but we plan to film you and release to the cloud later, and we'll keep the bear's location in Antarctica a secret.
Even so, they'll harass me for years to come.
But they do that already, right?
True. All right, I'll think it over. Amelia ended the call and looked up at Vlade and the policewoman. She couldn't help smiling.
The defenders?
Vlade asked. Defenders of the Earth. They don't like assisted migration.
Things are supposed to stay in place and die?
I guess. They want native species in native habitats. It's a good idea, but you know.
Extinction?
Right. So to me, you save what you can and sort it out later. But not everyone agrees. In fact, I get a lot of hate mail. The other two nodded.
No one agrees with anything, Vlade said darkly. Polar bears, Inspector Jen said. I thought they were gone already.
200 is like being gone. They'll join the zoo-only crowd pretty soon, sounds like. If the zoos can keep them alive to a cooler time, it'll be quite a genetic bottleneck. But, you know, better than the alternative.
So you'll do it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, talk about your charismatic megafauna. Yikes!
Your specialty,
Vlade noted. Well, I like everything. Everything but leeches and mosquitoes. Remember that time the leeches got me? That was gross. But the shows that get the biggest ratings definitely feature the biggest mammals.
And they're in the worst trouble, right?
Right. Definitely. Sort of. Although, really, she sighed. Everything's in trouble.
The outdoors is what you must pass through in order to get from your apartment into a taxi cab, said Fran Lebowitz.
G. Charlotte. Charlotte Armstrong's alarm went off, and she jabbed her wrist pad. Time to go home. Unbelievable how fast time went when you needed more of it. She had spent the afternoon trying to sort out the case of a family that claimed to have walked from Pennsylvania into New York by way of New Jersey. They told their story, ignoring the various impossibilities in it, insisting they had done it without actually being able to explain how they had finessed the checkpoints and marshes, bandits and wolves. No, they had not seen any of those. They had walked by night, walked on water, maybe, until, lo and behold, they were on Staten Island and getting picked up by a beat cop who asked for their papers. And they had none. She had sat with them in the holding tank at immigration all afternoon. They were scared. They truly did not seem to know where or how they had crossed in, although that was absurd. And yet, people were absurd, so who knew? Could be they had just kept moving night after night, one step at a time, like blind people. But they had one cheap wrist pad between them, so probably their actual course could be reconstructed from that, as she had suggested to them. But the case was not so serious that the immigration authorities had yet subpoenaed their wrist. Privacy laws fought immigration laws, with public safety tipping the scales such that caution almost always ruled. In reality, every case was a test. She had explained all that to them, and they had stared at her. For them to have any chance, she was going to have to be their representative in the court system. That was how it worked, most of the time. She had seen it 1,000 times. This was her job. Formerly a city job, now some kind of public-private hybrid, a city agency or an NGO or something, there to help the renters, the paperless, the homeless, the water rats, the dispossessed. Calling it the Householders Union had been aspirational at best. Just as she was finishing with them and packing to go home, the mayor's assistant, Tanganyika John, came in to ask if Charlotte could come over and help the mayor deal with an issue, great in importance yet vague in detail. Charlotte was suspicious of this, as she was of John, a supercilious woman, slender and fashionable, whose only job was to assist the mayor, meaning she was one of the defensive ramparts that the mayor erected around herself as a matter of course. The mayor had several people on her staff doing similar stuff, useful only to her reputation, while the city gasped and heaved for life under her. But, oh well, the tradition of an imperial mayor was very old in New York. Charlotte agreed with as much politeness as she could muster, and followed John down the hall and up the elevator to the mayor's administrative palace on the penthouse floor. There, three assistants, just like John, asked Charlotte to help the mayor write up a press release explaining why they had to impose immigration quotas for the good of the people already living in the city. Charlotte immediately refused. "You'd be breaking federal law anyway," she said. "They're very jealous of their right to establish these laws, and my job is to represent the very people you're trying to keep out." "Oh, no. Not really," they were explaining mendaciously, when the mayor herself breezed in to make the same request. Galina Estaban, beautiful in appearance, smooth in manner, arrogant in attitude, stupid in action. Charlotte was coming to believe that arrogance was a quality not just correlated with, but a manifestation of stupidity, a result of stupidity. In any case, here Galina stood, vivid in the flesh, making the same request, As if because it came from her, Charlotte could not refuse, even though they had been enemies for almost 10 years now. Galina seemed to think frenemy was a real thing, and not just hypocrisy. Then again, since she was a hypocrite, maybe that made the term real for her. In any case, Charlotte quickly disabused her of the notion that a personal request carried any weight. Galina responded with something about defending the borders of the great city they both loved, etc. "Defending the borders isn't possible when there are no borders," Charlotte said. Galina frowned, even pouted. Well, it had gotten her to the mayor's office, this pouty cuteness in the face of resistance. Charlotte met it with a stony glare. Through the pretended amusement and tolerance that followed, Charlotte saw the glint in the eye that indicated this was yet another little jab in their long battle, a parry riposte that would be added to all the rest. It was Galina who had dumped city immigrant services over the side. Public-private combine, worst of both worlds. "We have to get a handle on this issue somehow," Galina said, turning dark on a dime. "Pack people in too tight and there could be an explosion." "This is New York," Charlotte said. "It's a city of immigrants. You don't get to pick how many." "We can influence the number," Galina said. "Only by being a thug and breaking the law." "Explaining why we need quotas is not being a thug." Charlotte shrugged and excused herself. "Don't waste time on this," she suggested as she left. She stumped home on the sky bridges, looking down at the busy canals. She had started walking to and from work after her excursion with Inspector Jen. Every day now she found irregular high lines of her own devise. The original high line was underwater, and in its third life as an oyster bed. The current array of sky bridges ranged from boardwalks just above high tide to long catwalks at the 40th and 50th floors. They were almost all clear plastic tubes, reinforced by graphenated composite meshes so light and strong that they could span 4 or 5 blocks. Before her walk with Inspector Jen, she had almost always taken the No. 4 Vaporetto to work and back. But the canals could be so jammed that often as she watched from a Vapo, she could see walkers on the boardwalks moving quite a bit faster than her. And presumably it would be better for her health, at least if her feet could handle it. Have to work up to a daily walk both ways. Not sure if that would work, but trying it made her pay attention to herself in new ways. "Skip that dessert and you don't have to carry it home from work. Thus, you will hurt less." Pain as a spur to action. Oh yes, certainly not the first time for that. She got home just in time to change and eat a bite in the dining room before the weekly executive board meeting. Bit of a busman's holiday, this board. From city to building. The difference in scale made for somewhat different problems, but not that different. Well, she had volunteered for the board at a time when they were being sued and needed help. And even though it resembled her day job, it was interesting. As was her job, most of the time. She just needed some blood sugar and it would all be fine. Actually, a bit difficult to get that, as the food trays were almost empty when she got there. She had to scrounge scraps from the corners of trays and the bottoms of bowls. Might as well just put her face in the salad bowl and slurp like a dog, as those two boys ahead of her in line were doing. Damn! They were licking the bowls clean. Best be on time to dinner, as everyone knew. A long line formed in the half hour before opening. Residents were always present and accounted for when it came time for the important stuff, meaning no one would be at the executive board meeting. They really should try to whittle their population down to full capacity. She had made mistakes in that regard. A tendency to take people in was a professional habit, but a mistake when performed out of context. Too many mouths to feed. Dining hall jammed, very loud, people sitting on the floor against the walls with trays on their laps, glasses on the floor beside them. She did that herself, getting down awkwardly, wearily, knowing it was going to be tough to stand back up. One reason she wore pants in the evenings. Then up to the 30th floor, where they kept a room from which to run the building. She was only a little late, which would have been fine if she weren't the chair again. The others were sitting around talking about the two missing men. She sat, and they all looked at her. "What?" she said. "We're thinking that we shouldn't let anyone live on the farm floors anymore," Dana told her. The others were looking at her as if she was going to object, probably because she had argued to let the two men live there. "Because," she said, mostly to play to their expectations. "There isn't the security on the farm that there is in a room, as we saw," said Mariolino. He was board secretary this year. Charlotte shrugged. "I have no problem with putting the farm out of bounds. It was just a stopgap measure." The others were relieved to hear her say this. There were five of them there, now that Alexandra had arrived, and they ran down the items listed on the schedule. Complaint about noise, priority in the boathouse, desire for a bigger freight elevator, Vlade rolling his eyes at this, mentioning size of elevator shaft, wondering if a taller elevator car would satisfy the complainer. Dispute over the dues work credit formula, as applied to someone who thought cleaning the hallway on their floor was work deserving of a work credit. Relations with the LMMAS, pronounced lemas, or lame ass, depending on mood, the Lower Manhattan Mutual Aid Society, which was the biggest of many downtown cooperative ventures and associations, a kind of umbrella for all the rest of the organizations in the drowned zone. Exchange rates between the dollar and the lame-ass block necklace currency were so divergent between official and unofficial rates that Lemus had proposed they do away with the official rate and just let it float. Had to try to keep the wet currency as strong as possible if it was to succeed at all. And they needed it. So, currency policy. Just another building issue. On it went like that, as they ran their little city-state. Apartment 428 was empty because of the death of Margaret Baker. No heirs who wanted to move in. They lived in Denver and wanted to sell. Marge's contract with the co-op was rock solid. Charlotte knew this because she had helped write it. And so the Denver family was going to have to sell to the co-op for 100% of Marge's buy-in. Very fair. The co-op had a reserve fund dedicated to reacquisitions, so it seemed like it would be okay. But then Dana said, "If we bought it from them and then rented it to non-members, we could make the buyout price in about 10 months and then go on raking it in from there." 10 months? Charlotte asked. Alexandra and the others nodded. Rents in Lower Manhattan were shooting up. People were enjoying the Super Venice, and that was causing housing prices to rise. Intertidal aeration, they said it was called. Aeration, Charlotte said, in the way Vlade would say mildew. Don't they just mean inflation or speculation? I thought the second pulse had spared us all that. Not forever, she was told. Canal life was looking exciting. Hassles of daily life not evident to tourists, or to people so rich they could buy their way out of the hassles. "One of the rich people who wants to buy in here is Amelia Black," Vlade mentioned. "Her room and the parking share on the blimp mast. She said it would be a bit of a stretch for her, which surprised me, but she said she wanted a place in New York, and she likes it here." Would she work the co-op? Charlotte asked, feeling skeptical. Isn't she away a lot?
She said she would work the co-op. I'm sure she'd pitch in. She's that kind of person.
But wouldn't she be away a lot?
Sure. That's her job. But if we have a member who works the co-op when they're here, being away a lot is not the worst thing from my point of view. Less stress on the building, less water, power, sewage, more food left for others.
Charlotte nodded. Vlade thought the building's thoughts, and she valued that. The membership board can work that out with her, she said.
Membership sent her to us with a yes recommendation.
Okay, then. Let her buy in if they say so.
I'll tell her, Vlade said.
Where is she now?
The Arctic. She's going to fly some polar bears to the South Pole.
Really?
That's what she told me.
I don't know about this one. She sounds like trouble to me. But the membership committee has spoken. They moved on to other business, running down the schedule as fast as they could. All of them had been on the board long enough not to want to prolong a meeting. Vlade wanted his cathodic protection systems replaced on every steel beam in the building, and a new sewage processor to better capture and process their shit into fertilizer for the farm's soil, and more say on the Bacino's aquaculture board. He also wanted an upgrade in their electrical connection to the local power substation. The building's photovoltaic paint generated most of the electricity they needed, but there was a lot of back and forth electrically between them and the substation, and an upgrade would help. These were the main items on his wish list, he said in conclusion. The last item on the schedule had been added by Dana at the last minute, he said. There was an offer to buy the building.
What?
Charlotte said, startled.
Who?
We don't know. They're going through Morningside Realty and prefer to remain anonymous.
But why?
Charlotte exclaimed.
They don't say.
Dana looked down at his notes. Emmerich guessed it's a company from the Cloister Cluster, but that may just be because Morningside has its offices up there. They're offering us about twice what the building was last assessed at, $4 billion. If we took it, we'd all be rich.
Fuck that, Charlotte said.
Silence in the room.
We probably have to bring it to a vote, Mariolino said.
Vlade was scowling.
You have to?
Let's research it first, Charlotte said. They got up and briefly mingled near the window, mulling things over. Coffee for some, wine for others. Charlotte poured a stiff Irish coffee for herself, wanting both stimulation and sedation. It didn't work. In fact, it backfired, making her antsy but confused. An anti-Irish coffee. Must be an English coffee.
I'm going to bed, she said grumpily.
When she got to her room, which was actually just a bed and desk in one of the dorm rooms, separated from the rest of her roommates by sound quilts, she found a message from Jen Octaviosdottir on her screen. She tapped, and Jen picked up.
Hi, it's Charlotte. What's up?
Getting back to you about those missing persons in the building. Find anything?
Not much, but there are some things I can tell you about.
Breakfast tomorrow?
Sure, let's.
Maybe a mistake to put something else on her calendar and in her head right before bedtime, with an Irish coffee in her, no less. It was quite possible her brain would ramp back up and begin a spin cycle on this stuff, jazzing wearily through another night of insomniac pseudo-slumber, in and out until the light of dawn relieved her of the pretense to sleep. But in the event, she crashed and slept well.
I love all men who dive, said Herman Melville.
H. Stefan and Roberto. The sun rose under a high ceiling of frilly, pearl-colored clouds. Autumn in New York. Two boys pulled a small inflatable boat from under the dock floating off the Met's north building. The weight of the boat's battery-powered motor depressed it sternward, and the taller of the two boys sat in the bow to counterbalance that. The shorter one handled the tiller and throttle, piloting them through the canals of the city, east into the glare of the sun off the water. Rising tide near its height, the morning air briny with the tang of floating seaweed. They passed the big oyster bed at the Skyline Marina and emerged into the East River, then hugged the shore and headed north, staying out of the lanes of traffic marked by buoys on the water. By 9, they had gotten past Turtle Bay and up to 90th, and were ready to cross the East River. Stefan looked up and downstream. Nothing big coming either way. Roberto pushed the throttle forward, and their little prop under the stern lifted Stefan a few inches as they surged across the river.
I wish we had a speedboat. That would be so cool.
Meanwhile, slow down. I see our bell.
Good man.
Roberto slowed while Stefan put on a long rubber glove. Leaning over, he reached into the water and grabbed a loop of nylon rope and slipped it off their underwater buoy, which was anchored on the shallows that had once been the south end of Ward Island. He pulled up hard. The other end was tied to an eye at the tip of a large cone of clear plastic that was edged on its open end by a ring of iron, which kept that end pointed down. When he had hauled it near the surface, they both pulled it up onto the bow, then sat on the fat round sides of the boat, peering into the bell to see if anything had changed. All looked good, and Roberto crawled under the edge of it to stick their new gear to Velcro strips on its inside wall.
Looking good, he said as he crawled out from under it. Let's get it to Mr. Hexter's site.
They hummed up the west shores of Hellgate, and then over the shallows of the South Bronx. After a bit of tacking around and drifting, Stefan, consulting the GPS on their salvaged wrist pad, announced they were over the spot they wanted.
Yes!
Roberto cried, and tossed one of their improvised underwater buoys overboard. Two cinder blocks tied to a stolen nylon rope, the other end of rope tied to a buoy such that it would stay just under the surface even at low tide. X marks the spot. They tied the boat's bow line to the line floating up from the buoy, and sat there feeling hopeful. The tide would begin falling soon, but for now the river was still. Time to get to work. Roberto was their diver, because their dry suit was too small for Stefan to get into. All their gear had been scavenged in variously ambiguous circumstances, so they could not be too particular about anything. When Roberto was all zipped in, gloved and face-masked, they lifted the cone over the side with its open end down, getting it onto the water as flatly as possible, so that as it dropped slowly into the turbid water, they saw that a good amount of air had been trapped under it. The cone was just heavier than the air it had caught, so now it was a diving bell. Roberto grabbed the end of the air hose and took their flashlight in the other hand, and with a deep breath he slipped over the side of the boat into the water. He swam down and got under the rim of the bell, then rose into the air trapped under the bell. Stefan could just barely make him out. Then he swam under the edge and back up to the surface.
All good? Stefan asked. All good. Go ahead and let me down. Okay. I'll tug on the air hose 3 times when the oxygen is running out. You have to come up then. I'll pull the bell up on you if you don't.
I know.
Roberto dove under the bell again. Stefan let the nylon rope out hand over hand, allowing the bell to gently sink into the river with Roberto under it. They had only tried this a couple of times, and it still felt a little freaky. When the rope went loose, Stefan knew the bell was on the bottom, presumably next to or even on the cinder blocks marking their site. Their wrist pad's GPS showed that the boat was still on the right spot. He dialed the knob on their oxygen bottle to low flow, 1 liter a minute. Pretty soon that air would fill the bell, and he would see bubbles breaking the surface around the boat. The oxygen cylinder was one they had taken from a neighbor of Mr. Hexter's, an old woman who needed to breathe with one all the time, and so had a lot of them around in her room. Stefan had clipped together 2 sets of her air hoses, making 30 feet of tubing. And Roberto was now 17 feet under the surface, so all was well in that regard. Stefan couldn't see much of Roberto, and even the bell was just a kind of glow in the dark water, lit by Roberto's flashlight. But Roberto was